Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by. Welcome to the NOAA Monthly Climate Conference Call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. Instructions will be given at that time. If you should require assistance during the call, please press star then zero. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded. I would now like to turn the conference over to your host, John Bateman. Please go ahead.
All right, thanks, Greg. Good morning, and thank you for joining this monthly climate update call, part of the suite of climate services that NOAA provides to governments, business, academia, the media, and the public to support informed decision-making. I'm John Bateman with NOAA Communications, and I'll be facilitating the call today. If you have additional questions after the conclusion of today's call, my colleague John Leslie and I can both be reached by email at, and I will spell it, nesdis.pa@noaa.gov. That's nesdis.pa, as in public affairs, at noaa.gov. Today's update will feature three short presentations, followed by an operator-assisted question and answer session at the end. A copy of the presentation our speakers will follow can be downloaded from the link in the media advisory. However, one note, we had a last-minute update right before this call, so please make sure you download the most recent slideshow from that link. And with that, I will introduce our speakers. Our first presenter is Karen Gleason, Monitoring Section Chief at NOAA's National Centers for Environmental Information, who will provide a summary of the July 2024 U.S. and Global Climate Report, as well as the latest drought monitor updates. Our second presenter is Andy Hoyle, a research meteorologist with NOAA's Physical Sciences Laboratory, who will provide a review of the North American drought and related wildfire conditions that have been impacting parts of the U.S. and Canada this summer, including California's destructive park fire. And our third presenter is Brad Pugh, a meteorologist with NOAA's Climate Prediction Center, who will provide the latest El Niño-La Niña updates, as well as the U.S. seasonal outlooks for temperature, precipitation, and drought for September, October, and November. We will kick off this media briefing with Karen from NOAA NCEI.
Thank you, John, and thanks to everyone for joining the call today. Let's begin by looking at the global temperature data for July of 2024 on slide number two. We see that the global surface temperature anomaly was 1.21 degrees Celsius or 2.8 degrees Fahrenheit above the 20th century average, making this the warmest July on record by 0.03 of a degree Celsius above last July's value. This is the 14th consecutive month of record warm global temperatures. Global land-only temperatures for July also ranked warmest on record at 1.70 degrees Celsius or 3.06 degrees Fahrenheit above average. Ocean-only temperatures ranked second warmest on record for May at 0.98 degrees Celsius or 1.76 degrees Fahrenheit above average. This was 0.03 of a degree Celsius cooler than last July, ending the streak of 15 consecutive monthly record highs for ocean temperatures that spanned April of 2023 to June of 2024. Looking at the temperature departure map on the left and the corresponding percentiles map on the right, we see above average temperatures are denoted by shades of red and below average temperatures, shades of blue. Record warm July temperatures covered large parts of northern and southern Africa, southeastern Europe, and portions of Asia, as well as areas of the western U.S. and western Canada. Temperatures were warmer than average across most of the continents, with exceptions noted across Argentina and neighboring countries, as well as western Antarctica. Over the global oceans, record warm July temperatures covered large parts of the equatorial and northern Atlantic Ocean, although the expanse of record-breaking temperatures was less than what we've seen in recent months. Portions of the northern Indian Ocean, western Pacific Ocean, and southeastern Pacific Ocean also experienced record warm temperatures during July. Widespread areas of below average sea surface temperatures were largely confined to the far southeastern Pacific Ocean and adjacent areas of the Southern Ocean. Areas of the far northern Pacific Ocean also were cooler than average for July. During the month of July, approximately 13.8% of the world's surface had a record high July temperature, exceeding the previous July record set last year by 5.4%, and close to one-fifth of the global land surface had a record high July temperature at 19.2% coverage. Looking at continental temperature ranks, Europe, Africa, and Asia were each warmest on record for July, with North America second warmest, South America 13th warmest, and Oceania 29th warmest. Shifting our attention now to slide number 3, we see the January to July 2024 global temperature percentiles map and the year-to-date temperature anomalies plot for the 10 warmest years on record, as well as the annual temperature ranking outlook for this year. The January to July global surface temperature ranked warmest in the 175-year record at 1.28 degrees Celsius or 2.30 degrees Fahrenheit above the long-term average. Record warm temperatures occurred across much of the northern two-thirds of South America and stretched through Central America and much of Mexico. Record warm year-to-date temperatures also covered large parts of Africa and Europe, as well as parts of Southern Asia. Exceptions to the anomalous warmth included eastern Antarctica, where much cooler than average to record cold January to July conditions occurred, and cooler than average temperatures also occurred across the southern tip of South America. In a pattern similar to recent year-to-date periods, the first 7 months of the year had record warm sea surface temperatures covering much of the equatorial Atlantic and large parts of the subtropical Atlantic. Record warmth also encompassed much of the Indian Ocean and parts of the Southern Atlantic and Southern Ocean, as well as the Western Equatorial Pacific. Anomalously warm sea surface temperatures occurred in other areas of the globe, with the exception of parts of the Southeastern Pacific and Southern Ocean, Southwest Indian Ocean, and the Southwest Atlantic, as well as a small portion of the North Atlantic between Greenland and Iceland. Looking at the time series plot of the year-to-date temperature anomalies for the 10 warmest years on record, we see that the January to July year-to-date anomaly value for this year, as depicted by the black bar or black line on the graph, has been consistently above the other year-to-date anomaly values for the other warm years and is the warmest January to July period amongst those the warmest 10 years on record, with 2016 coming in second place through July and 2020 rounding out the top three at this point in the calendar year. And according to NCEI's annual temperature ranking outlook statistical analysis, as depicted by the bar plot on the bottom of this slide, there is a 77% chance that 2024 will end as the warmest year on record and a nearly 100% chance of a top five warmest year. Moving on now to slide number 4, we see July temperatures across the contiguous U.S. They averaged 75.7 degrees Fahrenheit, which is 2.1 degrees Fahrenheit above the long-term mean. This translates to a ranking of 11th warmest. Looking at the temperature ranks map on the left, we see that in general temperatures were above average to record warm across the western and eastern halves of the U.S., with below average temperatures concentrated across the central plains and the Midwest. California and New Hampshire ranked warmest on record for July. Precipitation for the month averaged 3.04 inches, which is about a quarter of an inch above average, and this falls into the wettest third of the historical distribution, which is an above average ranking. Looking at the precipitation map on the right, we can see the precipitation was below average across much of the western half of the U.S., as well as across portions of the Ohio Valley, where West Virginia ranked 8th driest. Above average precipitation occurred from Texas to the Great Lakes and along much of the East Coast. Illinois ranked 7th wettest and North Carolina 8th wettest. Looking now at slide number 5, We see temperature and precipitation rank maps for the January to July year-to-date period across the contiguous U.S. Temperatures averaged 54.5 degrees Fahrenheit, which is 3.2 degrees Fahrenheit above average, and this translates to a ranking of second warmest. Looking at the temperature ranks map on the left, we see the entire lower 48 had above average to record warm temperatures. Vermont and New Hampshire ranked warmest on record for this period, with an additional 25 states ranking among their five warmest such year-to-date periods on record. For precipitation, we averaged 20.44 inches, which is 2.36 inches above average, and that is a ranking of 11th wettest. Drier than average conditions were present across portions of the Northern Rockies, while wetter than average conditions were present across portions of the West Coast, Plains, Great Lakes, Deep South, Southeast, and Northeast. Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Rhode Island ranked second wettest on record for the seven-month period. Now looking at slide number six, and the latest confirmed billion-dollar weather and climate disasters on record, we see four new events, new disasters were confirmed this month, including one severe weather event in the southern U.S. in mid-May, wildfires during June and July in New Mexico, one severe weather event in the central and northeastern U.S. in June, and Hurricane Beryl in July. There have been 19 confirmed events identified through July, which is second only to 2023 for the highest number of events for the first 7 months of the year. These disasters this year consist of 15 severe storm events, one tropical cyclone event, one wildfire event, and two winter storms. Turning our attention now to slide number seven and the latest U.S. drought monitor map just released this morning, we see that approximately 22% of the contiguous U.S. is currently in drought. This is up about 3.5% when compared with early July. Drought conditions contracted considerably or were eliminated across a large portion of the Southeast, in part due to the remnants of Hurricane Debby, and across portions of the Midwest. Drought conditions expanded or intensified across parts of the Ohio Valley, the Central and Southern Plains, the Pacific Northwest, and the Northern Rockies. Outside of the contiguous U.S., drought coverage expanded and intensified across the Hawaiian Islands. And with that, I'll turn the presentation over to Andy.
Well, thank you very much, Karen, and good morning, everyone. I'm Andy Hoyle from the NOAA Physical Sciences Laboratory. So moving on here to slide eight, we show that drought has recently worsened in the western United States based on changes in the U.S. drought monitor between August 13th and June 18th. This U.S. drought monitor map indicates the number of classes that drought is degraded in browns or improved in greens between these two dates set 8 weeks apart. Drought has worsened over much of the western and northwestern United States, including California, Nevada, Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Utah, and Montana. Other areas where drought has worsened include the Southern Plains and Ohio and West Virginia. Drought has improved in several areas over the United States, including New Mexico, because of the North American monsoon, and the Southeast United States because of the remnants of Beryl. Moving on to slide nine, approximate cause for drought intensification in the western United States was due to a loss of moisture to the atmosphere compared to its supply from precipitation. To a first order, drought is caused by an imbalance of supply versus demand of moisture compared to historical averages. On the left, the average precipitation in July and August is shown, which indicates that little precipitation is observed over much of the western United States, which accounts for less than 10% of annual average precipitation. So in that sense, we don't expect much water supply by precipitation this time of year. On the right, the evaporative drought demand index is shown for the 8 weeks ending on August 8th of 2024, which indicates the demand of moisture by the atmosphere compared to historical averages. What's especially noteworthy is that much of the western United States, the demand of moisture by the atmosphere was exceptional due to warm temperatures that Karen had shown previously. Moving on to slide 10, we show that drought intensification led to vegetation health declines, which provides fuels for wildland fires. The map on this slide shows the Vegetation Health Index, which measures the greenness of vegetation compared to historical averages, and the temperature of vegetation compared to historical averages. So over much of the western United States, we see unfavorable conditions in the same areas in which drought emerged. And with these unfavorable conditions, this will lead to anomalously brown or anomalously warm vegetation conditions, or both, which provide fuels for wildland fires. Moving on to slide 11, we show the location of large wildland fires exceeding 500 areas or 500 acres burned in the western United States, with the U.S. Drought Monitor overlaid. The location of these wildland fires in the western United States closely corresponds to areas experiencing drought in which vegetation health is low. Most fires are located in the Pacific Northwest, which has experienced drought for several years now because of two consecutive wet seasons in which precipitation was below average. Eight large wildland fires are burning in California right now, one of which is the Park Fire, which I'll discuss in more detail in the coming slides. Now, getting more into the Park Fire, this is slide 12, and it shows conditions on the day of ignition for the Park Fire and the days following were conducive for wildfire spread. So in terms of the numbers, ignition of the Park Fire was on July 24, 2024, 2:52 p.m. The cause, the approximate cause, was arson, which was aided by weather and climate conditions that I'll outline in the following. And the area burned as of a few days ago was 429,263 acres, making it the fourth largest wildfire in California's history. The table on this slide shows conditions at the date of ignition. That's the column on the left, July 24, 2024, at 2:53 p.m. And these are conditions at Chico Regional Airport, which is the closest observing station to the fire's ignition. At that time, temperatures were 107 degrees Fahrenheit, relative humidity was low at 14%, and wind speed was 18 miles per hour from the south-southeast. Now, in the days following, what we show are those daily extremes for the 24th, 25th, and 26th of July. And as you can see, temperatures were 108, 102, and 102 degrees on July 24th, 25th, and 26th, respectively. Minimum relative humidities on those days were in the low teens percent. And wind speeds, maximum wind gusts on those days, were 29, 30, and 16 miles per hour. So wildfire spread on those days was aided by the weather and the climate. Now, moving on here to slide 13, what we show is the weather pattern on the day of ignition for the Park Fire, and that it was conducive for spread of wildland fires in the United States. The map on this slide is common perspective for showing weather patterns. It shows the height of the atmosphere at a given pressure, in this case 500 hectopascals, which is the middle of the troposphere, the part of the atmosphere where we see our weather. Higher heights indicate high pressure and that a column of air is really warm, whereas lower heights mean low pressure and that a column of air is cooler. Another important feature here in these maps to help us understand is how winds are moving in terms of the contours of these pressure levels. Air moves along these high contours, so we can tell the wind direction. Also, air moves faster along these high contours between regions of high and low pressure, so we can tell the wind speed too. The map indicates a large high-pressure area over the southwest and western United States, commonly referred to in the summer as a heat dome, and strong southwesterly winds for summer over the west and Pacific Northwest regions of the United States. Thank you, and I'll turn it over to my colleague, Brad Pugh.
Yes, thank you, Andy. Hello, everyone. I'm Brad Pugh from the Climate Prediction Center. And moving on now to slide 14. On the left-hand side, we have the average sea surface temperature anomalies from July 14th through August 10th. And those show that below normal sea surface temperatures are starting to develop across the eastern equatorial Pacific. But a little farther to the west, around 150 degrees west longitude, sea surface temperatures are closer to average. So the current oceanic and atmospheric observations reflect ENSO neutral conditions at this time. We'll also point out the very warm sea surface temperatures across the Gulf of Mexico, and those extend eastward through the tropical Atlantic. On the right-hand side is a bar graph showing probabilities for either La Nina, ENSO neutral, or El Nino. And you can see in the blue bar there, the La Nina probabilities are elevated as we move into September, October, November. There's a 66% chance of La Nina developing during the fall season, and a greater than 60% chance that La Nina persists through the winter of 2024-2025. And next slide, number 15, is the monthly outlooks for September. On the left-hand side is the September temperature outlook, which calls for above normal temperatures being favored for much of the contiguous United States. Highest forecast confidence for September temperatures to average above normal exists in northern New England and also over the Great Basin, Central Rockies, and parts of the Southwest. Equal chances of below, near, or above normal temperatures are forecast for most of Alaska. The September precipitation outlook favors above normal precipitation along the East Coast and also the Gulf Coast, with the largest probabilities for above normal precipitation forecast for the Florida Peninsula. We have below normal precipitation being favored for the central to southern plains, also most of the southwestern United States, and a slight tilt towards above normal precipitation in parts of the coastal Pacific Northwest and also western Alaska. And next slide, number 16, is the 3-month forecast for September, October, November. And we're favoring above normal temperatures for much of the lower 48 states, largest above normal temperature probabilities in excess of 60% are forecast for New England, also parts of the Southwest. Equal chances of below, near, or above normal temperatures are forecast along the West Coast and also much of the Pacific Northwest. And across Alaska, below normal temperatures are favored for southwestern Alaska and the Aleutians, with above normal temperatures more likely for northern Alaska. The September, October, November precipitation outlook favors above normal precipitation along the East Coast, with below normal precipitation more likely for the central to southern Great Plains, Southwest, and Southern California. Above normal precipitation is slightly favored for the Pacific Northwest, also Western Alaska, with below normal precipitation slightly favored for Southern Alaska. And just a couple of notes here on the precipitation outlook. The above normal precipitation favored along the East Coast, that is primarily due to the likelihood of an active Atlantic hurricane season. And the precipitation forecast for the Southwest, Southern Plains, and also the Pacific Northwest is consistent with La Nina, as we are expecting La Nina to become more of an influence later in the fall season. And final slide, number 17, is the seasonal drought outlook. As noted earlier, drought improved over the southeastern U.S. as we had Tropical Storm Debbie earlier this month track through the southeastern U.S. But we still have drought conditions continuing over the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia. But that area did receive beneficial rainfall from Debbie, so we're expecting drought there to continue to improve over the next few months. A little farther to the west, though, over West Virginia, southwestern Pennsylvania, and southeastern Ohio, drought persistence is more likely, as that region missed out on Debbie's rainfall. During late August through the end of November, drought persistence is favored for ongoing drought areas of the Great Plains, also the Rockies and Southwest. As you move a little farther westward into Washington and Oregon, typically during the fall, precipitation increases quite a bit, especially as you go into October and November. So we are expecting slowly improving drought conditions for Washington and Oregon by the end of November. And drought development is most likely over the central and southern plains, also the lower Mississippi Valley. Those areas shaded in yellow currently have antecedent dryness. The past 30, 60 days have been on the dry side, and we're favoring below normal precipitation and above normal temperatures during the next 3 months. So that those areas would be most vulnerable to drought development. And also just a note on the development areas there, northern Texas and parts of the lower Mississippi Valley could be rapidly going into drought over the next few weeks. Outside of the lower 48 states, there's a small area of drought in southeastern Alaska that should end this fall season. Drought persistence and development is forecast over Hawaii. And Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands are very wet right now, so they're likely to remain drought-free through the next few months. And that's my final slide, so I'll pass it back to John now.
All right, great. Thanks so much, Brad. We will now take specific questions from the call participants. Please identify who you'd like to answer the question if possible. And Craig, could you please tell the call participants how they can ask a question, and then please queue up the first question.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question, please press 1 then 0 on your telephone keypad. You may withdraw your question at any time by repeating the 1-0 command. If you're using a speakerphone, please pick up the handset before pressing the numbers. Once again, if you have a question, please press 1 then 0 at this time. And one moment, please, for your first question. Your first question comes from the line of James Dineen from New Scientist. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my question. I've seen lots of discussion sort of over the past few months about whether relatively high precipitation in 2023 and spring of this year marked the end of the, quote, mega drought in the western U.S., and I'm curious what you make of that given this seasonal drought outlook showing what looks like no drought in much of the western U.S.
Yeah, hi, James. This is Brad. So, yeah, the seasonal drought outlook, important to note that this is valid through the end of November.
Mm-hmm.
And with La Nina, we would expect, if La Nina continues through the winter, we would expect drier than normal conditions over Southern California and the Southwest. So I would say that as we head through the winter, that drought could redevelop in those areas through next winter. So that's something to keep in mind.
Can I just to add on to that, when you look at this map, this drought map from this year and compare it to, say, 2022, I mean, does it look substantially different? Just thinking about people arguing that the mega drought has ended because of wetter conditions.
Yeah, this time last year in August of 2022, yeah, there was very widespread severe to extreme drought over California and the Southwest. So that has ended. You know, these drought episodes do kind of wane and redevelop, and a lot of that's associated with La Nina. So, the good news is they're out of drought currently, but with La Nina forecast through the winter, Southern California and the Southwest will be vulnerable for a redevelopment of drought.
Thanks very much.
Your next question comes from the line of Nathan Mills from Chaucer. Please go ahead.
Hi. My question's in relation to your monthly forecast, so slide 15. What's your baseline climate normal that that you're using? What time period?
Yeah, the base period is 1991 through 2020.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Your next question comes from the line of Oliver Millman from Guardian US. Please go ahead.
Hi there. It's a question for Karen, if I may, just to clarify one thing to start with. I think you mentioned that July was the warmest on record for Africa, Europe, and the second warmest in North America, and yet the contiguous US itself appears to be the 11th warmest. Is that correct? Is that because Canada had a particularly warm July? And secondly, just on the string of record months now, 14 in a row, I wondered if you could reflect a bit on that personally, how kind of extraordinary or surprising do you find this to be? And do you expect this record to stretch on further or not, given the La Nina coming in?
Yeah, so this is Karen Gleason with NCEI. Just to reiterate, North America for July did rank second warmest, and then for the contiguous U.S., it was 11th warmest for July. And then looking at the streak of global record warm global temperatures, now sitting at 14 months and counting, the June 2023 to July 2024 streak, it exceeds the previous streak from 2015-2016. And the only other thing I can possibly add to that is that, you know, the margin of it being record warm this year, being 0.3 of a degree Celsius above last year, is a very small margin. So it's almost like a photo finish if you were considering a leg race or something like that. So it'll be interesting to see what happens next month and if we're able to, you know, stay a little bit above what we saw last year, or whether or not we will, not exceed last year's August value. So we'll be looking very closely at that. But we definitely see, when we look at the global maps, we see the large, broad areas of record warmth. They have shrunk a little. They have consolidated, but the globe still remains incredibly warm, even though it's not as expansive on the record warm side. So it's definitely something that we're keeping track of, and we will definitely provide the update next month, and we'll see if that 14-month record expands and grows to 15 months. So I hope that's helpful.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Haley Smith from Los Angeles Times. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks. My question is for Brad. Can you talk a little bit about why the onset of La Nina seems to have been delayed? And also, what can you say about its anticipated strength at this time?
Yeah, that's a good question, Haley. We were expecting the onset to be much faster in the summer, like going back to the springtime. I think one of the reasons it's been delayed is the Madden-Julian oscillation strengthened back in July and May disrupted the enhanced trade winds, which you really need to have over the equatorial Pacific to see those cooler than normal sea surface temperatures develop. So that could be one reason As far as the strength goes, there's still at this time pretty large model spread. The CFS model is showing a negative anomaly below minus one, where the European model is a little closer to minus 0.5. So, anything from a weak to moderate La Nina is possible.
Well, thanks.
You're welcome.
Your next question comes from the line of Mary Cunningham from CBS News. Please go ahead.
Hi there. My question is also about La Nina, and it's for Brad. I was wondering if you can speak to how its anticipated arrival and the sea surface temperatures will impact the hurricane season that's already well underway.
Yes. We're still expecting a very active Atlantic hurricane season. We have ENSO neutral conditions right now. But even with just ENSO neutral conditions, we have, very warm sea surface temperatures over the tropical Atlantic. So even with the delay of the development of La Nina, we're still expecting a very active hurricane season. And also, I just mentioned the Madden-Julian oscillation. Its enhanced phase recently propagated, or its forecast propagated from Africa to the Indian Ocean. And that is typically very favorable for tropical cyclone development over the main development region of the Atlantic Basin. So we're expecting over the next 2 to 4 weeks to be, fairly active over the Atlantic Basin. We have Ernesto right now. Bottom line is we're still expecting a very active season.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Your next question comes from the line of Jack Lee from the San Francisco Chronicle. Please go ahead.
Hi, I think this is a question for Karen Gleason. I saw that Copernicus data indicated that July 2024 was a bit cooler than July 2023, so I was just hoping to find out if there's a known reason why there's some differences with the NOAA data.
Jack, very good question. The various global data sets, each of them has something that's unique about them. The Copernicus data is reanalysis data, and so our data is all based on, there's no satellite data taken in consideration. It's ground truth and interpolating in between measurements. And so I think the take home is that given the fact that we, our record for the NOAA data set, the record warm July by 0.3 of a degree Celsius and it being so close to 2023, it's essentially very close to a virtual tie by all, intents and purposes. But I would say this, that the overall trend and the characterization of global temperatures over time, all of the global data sets, the primary global data sets, are all in alignment. They're all consistent. But there are going to be times and opportunities where one data set is going to have a slightly different statistic, but in general, they're all saying essentially the same thing. So we feel very strongly that, the Copernicus data and the NOAA global temperature data set are very much so saying the same kind of thing, and we're at or near record warmth for the globe. It just depends on how you combine and compile the data and what data you use in the analysis. And so there are enough differences there between the data types and the methodology that we're not going to have exactly or precisely the same numbers. But the consistency over time is, I think, the thing to really kind of take home, and that's that we are at or near record pace.
Got it. Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Evan Bush from NBC News. Please go ahead.
Thanks for doing this. I was curious about the 19.2% statistic about land mass. Is that unusual, or obviously it's record setting for nearly one-fifth of the Earth's land, but have we seen anything like that before?
Evan, great question. I'm assuming that's for me, Karen Gleason at NCEI. You know, I was looking at that statistic and thinking I probably should go back to the data set. I don't actually have the number right in front of me, but Evan, if we have your contact information, I'd be more than glad to shoot you an email after the call and you know, provide context for what the, you know, the next highest land percentage is. I just don't have that at my fingertips at the moment, but it is a record, as you stated, and as I said earlier.
Thank you.
And Evan, and this is John Bates. You can also reach out to me as well, and I can connect you with Karen if needed, since my email is in the media advisory.
And Mr. Bateman, there are no further questions. Please continue.
Okay. Thanks so much, Greg. If there are no further questions, I will wrap up the climate call. First, I'd like to thank our speakers for their time and to everyone else for participating in this conference call. And I will end by reminding all of you to mark your calendar for a few upcoming events. The release of the August 2024 U.S. Climate Report and Billion Dollar Disaster Summary is scheduled for September 10th. The release of the August 2024 Global Climate Report is scheduled for September 12th. And our monthly media climate call is scheduled next month on September 19th. If you have any further informational needs, please feel free to email me, John Bateman. My contact information is available at the top of the media advisory. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude your conference for today. Thank you for your participation and for using AT&T Teleconference. You may now disconnect.